You're listening to Beyond the Ribbon, a podcast of the Cancer Survivorship Center, powered by 24 Hours in the Canyon. This podcast is brought to you by Auto Inc. Auto Inc. is a distinguished family of dealerships redefining automotive excellence. Be sure to check out their website at autoinc.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ribbon. My name is Ryan Parnell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and oncology nurse, Pam McMillan.
Hey, Ryan. How are you today?
Pam, I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing good. You know, whenever somebody's diagnosed with cancer, what are maybe the top two things that they, first think of?
There's probably,
or would you think of,
a dozen things. They probably think about their family. They probably think about their job, and they probably think about how in the world am I going to pay for all this?
Yeah. You know, the financial burden of a diagnosis of cancer is overwhelming. You know, it's the co-pays, it's the prescription cost, it's, you know, being out of work. There's a lot.
And if you have insurance.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of that.
And knowing if you're going to the right doctor, you know, there's just so much stress on a cancer patient. And so I hope today we can make some clarity out of all that mess.
Oh, yes. You know, we cover a lot on this podcast, don't we, Pam?
We do. And uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, talking about finances is always difficult and can be challenging. And so you're right. This is a very good episode to hopefully maybe guide you guys that are listening, help you out. Also, maybe, you know, you may think, well, I'm doing pretty good. I've got it all covered. I bet you money, no pun intended, that there's something from this podcast that you will learn that will help you out while you're going through your treatment and after treatment, right, Pam? Because we know cancer, unfortunately, many times is the gift that just keeps on giving.
Yes, most definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, we reached into our plethora of resources, and we have a great resource that we utilize at the center a lot. Pam, I know you utilize their website or point people to them. But we have someone from Triage Cancer today, and not just someone, Pam. We have Monica Bryant. Monica is a cancer rights attorney, speaker, and author dedicated to improving access to quality information on healthcare-related issues. She's the co-founder and chief operating officer for Triage Cancer, a national nonprofit organization that provides education on the practical and legal issues that may impact individuals diagnosed with cancer and their caregivers. Monica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we always like to just start from the beginning, and let's just talk about, you know, what happens, you know, how does someone get into what is called financial toxicity when they're going through a treatment or cancer diagnosis?
So financial toxicity is a term that was coined by researchers out of Duke University to describe the financial burden or hardship that can happen after a cancer diagnosis. And what was interesting about this research is they looked at how that financial burden can be as significant as the physical burden that some of the cancer treatments cause, which is where we get that word toxicity from. It's interesting because you all mentioned a couple of things that are commonly considered the factors that contribute to financial toxicity: the co-pays, the prescription drug costs. At Triage Cancer, we actually believe that the most significant contributing factor to financial toxicity is health insurance status. And while certainly, as Ryan, you alluded to, that could mean not having health insurance at all, but what we find to be more often the case is that someone isn't effectively using the policy that they do have, or they don't have the right policy for them to meet their needs. And that can be for a whole bunch of reasons. So maybe it's about having a policy that doesn't cover the doctors that they want to see. And so that's why they have higher out-of-pocket costs. One of the challenges with health insurance is it's complicated. And what we find to be true more often than not is most Americans don't understand it.
It's
a lot.
Yeah, it is. You know, we have talked about before on our podcast, we've talked about, you know, open enrollment for Medicare, and we've talked about a variety of pieces and parts of that. And, you know, it is confusing for someone who's not at Medicare age. And unfortunately, we know folks who are going through cancer treatment, you know, suffer from chemo brain. Many times, shall we say, they're a little more seasoned in age. And so I can't imagine trying to navigate this in the confusing world that it is. So you talk about how underutilization or utilizing insurance incorrectly. I saw a statistic, or not a statistic, but a PowerPoint that talked about how there's three ways that you have insurance, right? You have your employer type of insurance, you have Medicare, Medicaid, government, VA, and then the last one, right, is like insurance company, directly from the insurance company. Is that correct?
That is correct. Those are the three ways that people get health insurance in this country.
So how do we know if we have the right insurance for us?
Well, there's no one size fits all to any of this, and it's going to come down to a number of factors. So generally, we want people to understand first the terms that are used in health insurance. And there's some terms that are used across the board, regardless of where you get your insurance. And so those are things like your monthly premium, which is how much you're going to pay each month just to have health insurance. Then there's your annual deductible, which you have to pay first before your health insurance kicks in. Then when health insurance kicks in, you have a cost share, which is a percentage. And so it's the difference between what you have to pay for your medical care and what your insurance has to pay. And then there's a co-payment typically. And so these get really confused, right? Cost share, co-payment, they're different things. A co-payment's a dollar amount. So it could depend on the policy, but it could also depend on the service. So for example, if someone's going to their primary care physician, they might pay a $20 copayment. But if they go see a specialist, now they're paying a $35 copayment. And if they end up in the ER, it's a $250 copayment. And one service could have both a copayment and a coinsurance. So it's understanding these terms and these words and what they mean. And frankly, there are studies that show that 96% of Americans don't even understand those terms. So if we don't understand the terms, how can we possibly be effective at picking the right policy? So that's the starting point, is understanding the words and then understanding what you have in your policy, what those different numbers might be. But then it's also about understanding the out-of-pocket maximum. And this is one of the most valuable things that people can know about their insurance. And first, is there an out-of-pocket maximum? Because not every policy has one. Like Medicare Part B, for example, does not have an out-of-pocket maximum. But if you do have a policy that has one, then it's about knowing what the dollar figure is, because that dollar figure is going to represent the most that you're going to pay out-of-pocket for your medical care for the year. And then it's about knowing what the math problem is. So for example, if someone has a plan that they've purchased through the state health insurance marketplace, which are private policies, but they're purchased through the marketplace that the Affordable Care Act created, the out-of-pocket maximum is everything you pay towards your deductible, everything you pay towards your co-insurance, and everything you pay towards your co-payments. So it's everything you're paying out-of-pocket for your care, except those monthly premiums. And the reason that's so helpful to understand is A, it lets us plan around a worst case scenario. So even if someone is totally healthy, if they want to make sure that they're protected from some of this financial hardship, making sure that, for example, they have the amount of their out-of-pocket maximum saved could keep them from entering into debt. It's also critical because it's how you're going to effectively pick the right policy each year. And you can then plan around which policy is actually going to be the least expensive.
Right. So correct me if I'm wrong. Where you're going with this is, if you have like the bronze, the silver, the gold, the platinum, the whatever plans to choose from, right? And so on first look, the lower cost per month seems more reasonable because it costs you less per month, right? But you do your math equation and you find out, for not all plans, but some plans, the higher the monthly payment, you reach that point faster. And with a lower deductible, and therefore your total spend is less, correct?
That's exactly right. So, and basically the way you figure it out is you take that monthly premium and you multiply it by 12, because that's what you're going to pay in premiums for the year. And then you add it to your out-of-pocket maximum. And if you do that for all of the plans that you're considering, then you can actually see in dollars and cents, in a worst case scenario for the year, how much are you going to pay for your healthcare?
So for newly diagnosed patients, how can they go about getting help understanding insurance?
I mean, I'm obviously biased, but we have tons of information at Triage Cancer. And we present the information in a variety of formats because we recognize that people learn in different ways. So some people are visual learners. Some people want to watch something or read something. But then also we recognize that people are at different capacity levels, particularly when you're newly diagnosed. Because here you are in a situation where it's scary. You're probably being pushed to learn all sorts of medical information that maybe is completely foreign. And then on top of it, you have to learn about all of these different legal issues or understanding insurance. And so we have information from the most basic 5-minute animated video that talks through what the terms are and then how to do that math, to you know, an entire tool on our website that's interactive that has, you know, in the weeds information called cancerfinances.org. So I think it is about, for each person, kind of understanding how they learn and what capacity level they have to, you know, retain new information.
But the best takeaway point from that, though, is there is help available. You don't have to struggle through this. You don't have to, you know, go to Google and spend hours wondering if you're looking at, you know, information that's actually pertinent and reliable. Triage Cancer provides that for you. So you guys make sure if you're needing information and need to learn about this, look them up. It's very vital for that. And we're not getting paid by Triage Cancer. So it's a great, great resource for you guys. You talked about too, using your healthcare effectively. You know, we've talked about maybe choosing the right type of healthcare plan and locations and how to go about that, but how do we utilize it effectively?
There's a couple different ways. I think the starting place is to make sure that the providers that someone is using, and that could certainly be doctors, but it's also about like labs and imaging centers, pharmacies, that all of those providers or services that they're receiving are from in-network providers. And this concept is foreign to a lot of people, but most health insurance plans have a network of providers that they've contracted with. And if you go to an in-network provider, your care will be covered at a higher rate. And then there are some types of plans that don't cover anything if you go out of network. So I think step one is ensuring that any service someone is receiving is from an in-network provider. Step two is if someone receives a denial of coverage, and this happens all the time, they understand that they don't have to take no for an answer. In every type of health insurance, Medicare and Medicaid included, there is a process to appeal those denials. And the process is slightly different in terms of the details, depending on what type of insurance you have. But the appeals process is wildly underutilized. And what that means is either someone doesn't get the care they need because they think they can't pay for it without the insurance coverage, or they get the care and then they're saddled with huge amounts of debt.
Yeah. Pam, how many times have you heard, and I know I've heard several times, well, my insurance is dictating my care. The insurance is dictating my treatment. And what Monica's saying is, be your best advocate.
You know, I feel like sometimes I know as a primary care nurse at one of the treating facilities, it was like, how many hoops can you put our patients through? And in the end, the insurance will pay for it. But, you know, they get that no first. So they just think, okay, well, that's no is no. in
the Yeah, and it happens. It's unfortunate because it does place a burden on the providers and the facilities too, because typically to get a successful appeal, patients are going to need the help of their doctors. But then it's also added stress and more on the plate of people who are dealing with a really significant medical situation. So it is certainly a problem. That being said, there are two levels of appeal for marketplace and employer plans. There's an internal appeal where you go back to the insurance company and essentially ask them to reconsider. But then there's also an external appeal where patients can go to an independent entity and have them look at the situation to decide if it's medically necessary or not. And when people go to the external appeal stage, between 40 and 60% of those appeals are decided in favor of the patient.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's a lot. So even conservatively, we're talking about half the time when the insurance company says no, they're getting it wrong.
Wow. So let's take, for instance, the internal appeal gets denied. Are you able to uncover or ask why they denied it and then utilize that in your external appeal?
In fact, insurance companies are required to explain why they are denying the claim. And then based on that information, that should help patients figure out what evidence they need to gather to prove that medical necessity. And the evidence can be all sorts of things. It could be a letter from the doctor. It could be a personal narrative. It could be journal articles or, you know, if a study has come out. So lots of things can speak to medical necessity, but insurance companies are required to share that information.
You know, I'm just thinking as a patient going through this stressful time, and then having the burden to appeal the denials, is there not any help for patients to help with that process?
Many times it's the provider's office that will help, and it falls on nurses and social workers and navigators typically to do those things. We certainly at Triage Cancer have a number of tools to try to explain the process based on the type of insurance and give examples, but it is definitely a challenge. I will also just tell you that even though the appeals are pretty successful, as we've just talked about, we also know that just in 1 year, there were 48 million marketplace claims denied. 99.9% of them were never appealed.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. That is a huge amount.
So again, when you logic that out, that means those people are either aren't getting the care they need, yeah, or here we are back at financial hardship.
Wow. They are, in that case, Pam, they are allowing the insurance to dictate their care if you're not feeling it. Oh my goodness.
Right.
You know,
another thing with insurance is, you know, the authorization. Is it the patient's responsibility or is it the healthcare provider to get that authorization?
It is a great question, and there's a lot of confusion around this. At the end of the day, it is the patient's responsibility to make sure that the prior authorization was obtained. Now, many providers do it on behalf, or, you know, ask for the prior authorization on behalf of the patient, which is a lovely service. But patients really should be double checking and making sure that that gets submitted, because if someone receives care that required a prior authorization without one, then the insurance company can deny covering that service, even if they would have granted the prior authorization. Okay. Now, sometimes in situations like that, patients can make the argument that, you know, they were told by the provider that it was submitted, like there was some evidence. Then they can ask for what's called a retroactive prior authorization.
But again, you've got to ask. You've got to do the work.
Exactly. Good. Yeah, there's unfortunately not a whole lot of easy buttons in this situation.
How many hoops can you go through, right?
Right.
And we're talking about just with your medical provider. We're not even talking about at the pharmacy, right? That's a whole nother set of hoops, where you may have a prescription that you're prescribed and the pharmacy, you know, tells you, oh, you have to try and fail three of these others before they you get to this one, or this is not approved. I mean, that's a whole other set of discussions, right?
But that's still about somebody's medical insurance coverage. It's just not the medical benefit, it's the prescription drug benefit. So it's still the same discussion around appeals. And so what you're referring to about like try and it doesn't work is referred to as step therapy. If there's a medical reason as to why step therapy isn't appropriate for a patient, that's something that can be appealed. The provider can show why it's medically necessary. So maybe there's an allergy to the capsule that the lower step is, and so that's why they need to step up to this other drug. So again, it does come back to that same conversation around don't take no for an answer. If there is a medical reason why someone needs A over B, that should be appealed.
Yeah. Pam, I'm sure you got a lot of that when you were in your previous role, right?
Yes. You know, we were always fighting for the patient. And it's hard, you know, because patients initially, you know, they get the denial and then they just want to accept that. And we always told them, you know, make sure you come back to us. Let us know. Let us know if you can't afford this. Or I did as a nurse. So
that's amazing. Hopefully
there's other ones out there like that as well. You know, the other confusing thing is whenever bills come in, how do we truly know if it's a bill that we need to pay or if it's an explanation of benefits or if it's just insurance sending us information?
That is a common question, because when someone receives medical care, they could get all sorts of communications, both from the insurance company and then also the provider. You mentioned the explanation of benefits or the EOB. For those of you that aren't familiar listening, that's a document that insurance companies will send explaining what something cost, the amount that the insurance company is going to cover, and then also the amount that the patient is responsible for. That's not a bill. And in fact, the way that someone knows that they're looking at an EOB is somewhere in, you know, big bold letters, it should say, this is not a bill. Then they're going to get the bill from the provider, which is in fact a bill. The real challenge here is that it doesn't always happen in that order. Providers like doctor's offices or labs are much faster typically at sending the bill to the patients than the insurance company is at processing the claim. So if a patient pays that bill before they get their EOB, they might be paying the provider more than the provider is actually owed. And now we're in a situation where someone has to try to get money back. Instead, we suggest that people should always wait until they've gotten their EOB before they pay their bill. And that way, we can make sure that the patient's paying the right amount, but also to just double check everything that was billed to make sure that they actually received all of the services and there aren't, you know, mistakes. Because at the end of the day, medical billing is a human process and humans make mistakes.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that people are paying only what they are actually supposed to be paying.
Does insurance have like a time frame where they have to pay the bill?
Yes, but it is complicated and confusing. And there's, you know, things can get resubmitted if things are submitted incorrectly, which pushes the time frame. So it's not an easy answer to be able to say like in X amount of time. But what we generally tell patients is if they've gotten a bill from the provider and they haven't gotten the EOB yet, just call the provider to say, I got your bill, but I haven't yet received my EOB. Can you push back the due date of the bill? Or can you make a note in my file? I have yet to hear of a provider having a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Here again, you know, advocating for yourself. It's funny, Pam, I always think of when you get a complex medical bill, like from a surgery or something like that, I equate it to the proverbial cell phone bill that you just can't follow, understand. And it's, you know, 8 pages and it's confusing. And I can't imagine, as we've discussed, going through treatment, having, you know, tough decisions to make, trying to understand these bills. What would you say to someone about asking for clarification or going over it with a fine-tooth comb, finding someone else that can help you with this?
So I think that we are seeing a thread, a theme of this podcast around advocacy and self-advocacy, but that's really what it takes. It takes someone going through the bill and asking questions, especially because some ELBs don't even have words on them. They're just these codes called CPT codes that refer back to a particular service. And the average person isn't going to know what a certain CPT code connects to, like what service is that actually? And so if someone has one of those bills or those EOBs, they need to call the provider and they need to ask questions. Now, I think that this is a great place to engage friends and family, frankly. So in situations where there's a whole lot of mail that could be super overwhelming and like, who wants to sit and go through a pile of bills? Well, maybe you ask a friend who has said, you know, let me know if there's anything I can do. Yes. What you can do, you can go through my mail, open it all up, throw away the junk, find the EOB, match it to the bill, staple it together so that all I have to do is go through a very clean stack. Can you get on the phone and ask my provider what all these CPT codes are? And so, I mean, it sounds sort of simplistic, but, you know, we often talk about like we all have a finite amount of energy, all of us. And when you're going through a serious medical diagnosis, that energy pool becomes more shallow, right? You're physically exhausted many times. It's emotionally exhausting on top of all the other things you're doing in life. And so anywhere where you can think about what are things that I can hand off so that I can sort of preserve those energy pieces.
It's the spoon theory, Pam. Remember that?
Yes.
You only have a finite amount of spoons in the day. And every time you do an activity, you're utilizing a spoon. And the more spoons you can save, the more energy and things you have at the end of the day.
That's great.
You were talking about paperwork. What is important paperwork that you should keep and what can you really get rid of?
Well, I do think that it is important to keep medical records. I think it's important to keep bills and EOBs, any sort of documentation around non-reimbursed expenses. So, for example, if someone has had to travel to treatment or they're paying $20 a day to park at their facility and that's not reimbursed, all of those things should get added up because they could, depending on the amount, it could be tax deductible at tax time. But in order to claim those deductions, you're going to want to have the evidence of it in case the IRS asks for it. The paperwork adds to the overwhelm, I think, for a lot of people. We have actually a couple different resources on our website around organizing and dealing with the paperwork with some just real practical strategies about how someone could handle that. So is it paper files? Is it folders? Is it electronic files? Again, that might be something that you could hand off to a friend or family member who wants to help. Like, here's my pile of receipts. Can you scan them into one PDF for me? Because you do want to keep those records for tax purposes. And then certainly the medical records are going to be important, I think, for everyone to have copies of their medical records. But then certainly those could become important if someone does need to do an appeal.
Right. So now you got it all organized. Now it comes to paying the bill and you don't have enough money. What are some suggestions you could tell our listeners when it comes to that time?
Well, I think there's a couple pieces to that. So there are certainly financial assistance options out there. There is definitely not enough to meet all the need. So I will say that right now. The other challenge with the financial assistance piece of this conversation is that there's no common application. So every foundation or nonprofit that provides financial assistance has different eligibility requirements, has a different application, and just sorting through what someone might be eligible for is exhausting and probably going to use up a number of spoons. So I don't say that to be, you know, negative, but just to kind of manage expectations for someone who is seeking financial assistance. But then it's also helpful to look at the source of the bill. So for example, is it from a nonprofit hospital? because some because nonprofit hospitals are actually required to provide what's called charity care. But typically that's not something a hospital is really screaming from the rooftops. So again, it's another place where a patient has to know about it to then ask, would I be eligible for charity care for this bill?
Yeah. Working in a previous nonprofit setting, it is. There are those requirements, and it is, again, it's another application process. It does not hurt to ask. You know, even some for-profit hospitals have a pot of money, although it's probably less, but they probably do have a pot of money, and it certainly does not hurt to ask. I will say real quick, an interjection for our foundation that does do financial assistance. We have tried our best to make the process of applying for the financial assistance as easy as possible. You don't even have to do it on paper anymore. You can do it online. You can do it through our app. Cancer Survivorship Center is the app name. The requirement is active treatment, and you live in the 26 counties of the Texas Panhandle, and we'll get you some help. And there's some interesting pieces of to note is what we will pay for and not pay for. But that's a conversation for another time. But just to say, I agree with you, and we recognize that, because how many times have you filled out paperwork throughout your cancer journey? Probably every single time they're updating their medical records, they're updating their system. You need to apply it if there's any changes for this. So we recognize that, and we want to make it as simple as possible. And to make it as easy as you can for that. You know, sometimes too, right, if you, they'll negotiate with you a lot of times if you're going to be paying cash, correct?
Yeah, so there are actually a number of strategies. So if someone, for example, is knowingly going to an out-of-network provider, because maybe that's the specialist that they need to see, they can negotiate even before treatment to say, you know, if I pay cash or if I pay up front, will you give me an in-network rate, you know, or can you put me on a payment plan? Or if I pay you cash right now, will you accept a lower lump sum? People generally don't think about negotiating with their healthcare providers, but it's actually pretty common.
You can also get on a payment plan where, you know, maybe it's easier for you to pay it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing about this conversation that sometimes gets forgotten is, are there ways that someone could maintain their employment while going through treatment so that they do have the money to pay the bills? And it's not obviously possible for everybody, but there are a number of laws and programs that could be useful to someone who can work through treatment, but just needs a little bit of help doing that.
Right.
Yes. And we did a podcast on the discussing the legalities of, you know, going back to work and working during treatment. And I would encourage you guys to go back and listen to that. It was very enlightening. You do have a lot of rights that you can ask your employer for accommodations, certain things to be made available to you and adjustments. And so, again, you talk about self-advocacy. That's one of them, because, it never hurts to ask, but in that case, right, you do have some legal benefits.
Yeah. I mean, the details definitely are important here. Like, the Americans with Disabilities Act only applies to employers with 15 or more employees that provides the reasonable accommodations, but then there are state laws. And so at triagecancer.org, we have charts of state laws on health insurance rights and employment rights and disability insurance. So you can look to see what's available in your state. And I will also just say, because I don't think I said it earlier, everything that Triage Cancer provides, we provide for free to anyone with any type of cancer. So listeners can feel welcome to take a look at any of those resources. The other piece about employment is sometimes it's not possible to work through treatment. Sometimes someone has to take time off. And that could be for a short amount of time, or it could be for a significant amount of time. And so if it is a situation where someone can't work, then they might want to explore what options they have around disability insurance, which is insurance that replaces a portion of the income that they're losing because they can't work due to their medical condition.
Is there a one-stop shop to go learn about disability insurance?
TriageCancer.org.
Come on, Pam.
I just want to make sure our listeners know where we want them to go. You know, it's hard because it's how do they apply? Where do they go? We get that often. And so, you know, it's nice to know that there is an organization out there trying to help the patients, and it's right in our price range. Free.
Yeah. There's a reason why we like Triage Cancer, right, Pam? We're very similar. We are incredibly similar, you know, in the fact that everything we provide at our center is entirely free. And you know, I think you guys would obviously echo what we always say is we know cancer treatment, as we've discussed, is incredibly expensive. We want to provide what we can at no charge to them to help them, you know, get back on their feet, stay active, be engaged, be involved, and provide those resources. So we cannot stress enough the importance of utilizing TriageCancer.org.
And is there any important dates that we should let our listeners know about insurance and enrolling?
Yes. So we talked earlier about picking the right health insurance, and that is not a one-time chore. That is something that every single one of us should be looking at every single year. And that's because every year there is a period of time when we get to make some choices. And that is generally referred to as open enrollment. So this is a time where someone can purchase a new plan. It's a time when someone can switch plans. And this is going to exist in all types of insurance. So whether you're buying it from an insurance company, whether you're getting it through the marketplace, whether it's Medicare or employer sponsored. If someone is on Medicare, then their open enrollment period is between October 15th and December 7th every year. And this is, again, where someone can pick up pieces of Medicare. It's where they can make different choices. For the marketplace, the open enrollment is November through January. Both Medicare and Marketplace are calendar year plans. So they start January 1st. Mm-hmm. It is important if someone wants a plan from the marketplace to start January 1st, that they enroll before December 15th. So don't wait till the end of the month to enroll, because then your plan might start later. If someone has an employer plan, employers can actually choose when their open enrollment is going to be. So sometimes employers do a fiscal year. Many will do a calendar year to coincide with the January 1 start date. But again, if you have an employer plan, you need to check your employer's open enrollment period.
All very good information. I mean, it's so much. And again, as we started out saying how confusing everything can be, everything's confusing based on which route you go. And so thank you for sharing that, Monica. Is there anything else that we've missed? Anything else that we've left out that would be important to impart to our listeners?
I think particularly around the financial hardship piece, many times it is because they don't have the right insurance policy for them, because when they picked it, they maybe didn't have cancer. And so they did pick something with a lower monthly premium because they didn't expect to be using it all that much. Or maybe now they're in a situation because their bills are racking up because they can't see the providers they want to see. You know, the provider they want to see is out of network. Because we have this option now to change plans every year, and because thanks to the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies can't charge us more or deny us if we have a pre-existing condition, we can really make the right choice for us each year. So even if someone is incurring big bills this year, come open enrollment at the end of the year, they can look for a new plan for next year. It doesn't solve the problems of the bills that they currently have, but it will help with continuing to incur big bills. And then it also makes it so that, you know, maybe those financial assistance options are going to be more helpful to deal with the bills they've already incurred. That is not something a lot of people think about.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's obviously, unfortunately, it's not retro active for, you know, those bills you've got. But if you're really struggling with that, and you just got to make it to the next enrollment date and then make a change,
which is coming up very soon.
It is. And I will say too, Pam, you know, we did the podcast talking about Medicare with the Amarillo Area Agency on Aging. And so that's another resource locally that you can sit down with. You can reach out to them. I know they do lots of panel discussions and educational seminars and so forth. So reach out to them and get in touch and get on their calendar, check them out. That's another resource that's local that someone, if you want to speak to someone face to face, that they can help you with it.
And Ryan, can I just add that those agencies on aging, are really phenomenal resources because they are unbiased entities. That is very different than talking with an insurance broker. Because insurance brokers are paid by the insurance companies to enroll people in certain plans. And so if someone is in a situation where they are concerned, they want to make sure they're getting the best plan for them, those entities that are, you know, globally referred to as SHIP programs are really, really valuable resources. And a similar resource exists through the marketplace. So there are marketplace assisters who are paid through federal grants and are unbiased in with respect to which plan somebody chooses. They can sit down with someone and help them go through the marketplace application and help them figure out which plan might be best for them.
That's great.
Such a great resource.
Yes.
Monica, thank you so much for educating us on financial toxicity and our listeners. That brings us to our last segment. We are sponsored by the Auto Inc. family. Do you have an Auto Inc. inspiring moment that you would like to share with our listeners?
I do. So we, a few weeks ago, spoke with someone who was in a situation where she could no longer work through her treatment. And her employer was incredibly generous. And so she had access to a private disability insurance policy. She had great insurance through her employer. She lived in a state with state disability insurance. But the problem was she was so overwhelmed by all of these different things. So here was a situation where someone had so many benefits, but she didn't know how they all fit together. And she was leaving her job and she didn't know what to do with any of it. And so when she called us, she was incredibly overwhelmed. It was impacting certainly her emotional health, but also her physical health. And in about 30 minutes, we were able to explain what all the different pieces meant to her and how they were going to benefit her and what next steps she needed to take. We heard back from her that she was actually doing much better and that she was in a financial situation where she could stay out of work for about a year to finish her treatment. And it just goes to show the power of information and knowledge and what it can do for somebody's life.
Understanding what you have and using what you have is so important, but can be so overwhelming, you know, and there's so many people out there that would be happy to help. You know, give your family member that's their chore to understand your insurance. So
yeah,
thank you so much for sharing that. That's very impactful. Ryan, you know, I feel like I'm going to be less stressed when you come around and say, is this the insurance you want to choose this year? I know I learned something.
Yes, as I will tell you, our open enrollment is approaching very soon. So this is all very pertinent, right? You know, the beautiful thing that I really want to leave our listeners with is you don't have to know all the answers. You don't have to do it all. There are people who know the answers, such as triage cancer. There are people that are willing to help you. Take advantage of those people. Surround yourself. You know, add these people to your team. not just your doctor, your nurse, your nurse practitioner, whoever that is, you know, your medical team, add in a social worker, add in a, you know, someone who knows someone, you know, I mean, people want to help you and take advantage of that help. I think that that's a true testament to what Monica, you just shared with us, with being able to help that person navigate and understand all the benefits they have. Pam, I think, I hope, I feel like I backed up what I said in the beginning, that someone's going to learn something from this podcast.
Absolutely. Monica, before we leave, can you let our listeners know where they can find you at?
Yes. So the best place to start is our website at triagecancer.org. That's TRIAGECANCER.org. I will also just share that if someone is listening that maybe doesn't have a cancer diagnosis, but would still like to learn some of this information, our most recent program is called Triage Health, where we have a companion website where we're providing all of this information around health insurance and employment and disability insurance and estate planning for free, but not with the word cancer on it. So we want to make sure that everybody who needs this information can access it and feels like it's for them.
Yeah. It doesn't just, it's not just cancer, right? It's health insurance. It's just, it's not cancer insurance. It's health. I mean, there is that, but this is health insurance. And so it covers for everybody. What a great idea. Pam, I always love our podcast. I enjoy visiting with folks and imparting this knowledge. And I do. I hope everybody learned something today.
Yes. You know, it's not just for cancer patients. It's anybody that needs health insurance, which is everybody.
Right. That's right. Well, I tell you, I think our homework for our folks is just to make sure that they do understand their health insurance, if they have health insurance. And then maybe just go tool around on triagecancer.org. I think that'd be a great, check them out, go there, look around. There's probably, as Monica said, there's a number of ways, whether it's animated, whether it's a PowerPoint, you know, whatever your style of learning is, they've got it. They've got it.
Great webinars, they've got all kinds of tools that anybody can utilize.
Right. And it's free. And I think that's another thing to point out too, Pam, is we are a resource here. Reach out to us. If we don't know the answer, we're going to help find the answer for you. But we can be a resource for you as well. Well, thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of Beyond the Ribbon. Make sure to join us next time for another great episode.
Thanks again for listening to Beyond the Ribbon. We'd like to extend a special thanks to the Auto Inc. family of dealerships, as they have supported the 24 Hours in the Canyon Cancer Survivorship Center since 2016. For more information on the Cancer Survivorship Center, please visit our website at 24survivorship.org.